Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Hi, I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of Jerusalem Unplugged. In this podcast, we will not only explore the fascinating history, politics, society, and incredible people of Jerusalem, but also unravel how this city plays a significant role on the global stage. So join me in uncovering the multifaceted stories that make Jerusalem not just a local gem, but a force that resonates worldwide. My guest today is Lauren Leibarger. Lauren is the author of a very important book, Palestinian Chicago, Identity in Exile. And Lauren is exploring the Palestinian community of Chicago, which is the largest in the United States of America. Well, some may say that now, currently, the community in New York might be a little bigger, but certainly, historically speaking, the Palestinian community of Chicago has been always the largest one. And as already mentioned in a previous episode, the connection between Chicago, Palestine, Chicago, and Jerusalem are sometimes hidden and have to be found. Like in the case of the American colony in Jerusalem, which was established originally by a family coming from Chicago. So Chicago, as I said, is home to one of the largest, most politically active Palestinian immigrant communities in the United States. For decades, secular nationalism held sway as the dominant political ideology. But since the 1990s, its structures have weakened and Islamic institutions have gained strength. So, Lauren, drawing on extensive fieldwork and interview data, Palestinian Chicago charts the origins of these changes and the multiple effects they have had on identity across religious, political, class, gender, and generational lines. The perspectives that emerge from this book and through this rich ethnography challenge prevailing understanding of secularity and religion. So to offer a critical insight into current debates about immigration and national belonging. But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So I just want to start with something about yourself. So can you tell us something about you and the origin of the book? And I'm curious how your experience in Palestine, as you will tell us, the listeners later, connected with Chicago, which is where I'm sitting right now.
Well, yes, thank you for that question. So I teach at Ohio University, as you know. I am a professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies, and I teach courses on Islamic studies, comparative religion. But my work, as this is often the case with those of us in academia, our research may or may not necessarily connect directly with our teaching, but my research has focused primarily on Palestinians, and specifically on the impact of religion on Palestinian national identity. Now, I got interested in that question as a consequence of the many years that I spent living in Palestine, in the West Bank, as well as in Gaza. I, in between, spent time living in Egypt as well. But altogether, I think I was in Palestine for about 6 years, 3 years initially from 1986 to 1989, where I was working with an organization called the Mennonite Central Committee. The Mennonites, you know, developed, as you might know, from the Radical Reformation, and half my family are Mennonites, so I was very familiar with the Mennonites and knew about the Mennonite Central Committee, which is the relief and development arm of the Mennonite Church in the United States and Canada. After college in 1986, I decided that I wanted to work abroad as a volunteer. I was very interested in Latin America. I had studied in Bogota and Colombia as part of study abroad, and was interested in the very concerned about the impact of U.S. foreign policy in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, other locations. I wanted to work there, but the Mennonites and the other organization I applied to, the American Friends Service Committee, had nothing for me in Latin America, but the Mennonites circulated my application globally to their various projects in this school in the West Bank, in Beit Jala, just south of Bethlehem, asked me if I'd be willing to come and teach English on a three-year volunteer term. And I knew nothing. I knew nothing about Palestine. Absolutely nothing. I didn't know where the West Bank was. But the college I was at, Earlham College, a small Quaker college at the time, had been running a study abroad program in Jerusalem that exposed students to Palestinian as well as Israeli perspectives. And so the issue was very alive on my campus in the 1980s. And so I started talking to those students, speaking with professors, and decided, you know, this is an extremely important issue. I need to learn about it. So I decided to go. In 1986, then I began teaching English. And then, within a year already, by December of 87, the first Palestinian intifada began. And pretty quickly, the military closed all of the schools in response to the mass demonstrations that were occurring. Many of my students were arrested, some were shot. And when the schools were closed, I found myself needing to find something else to do. I participated briefly in the attempt to start house schools, so in Beit Sahur, which is in the Bethlehem, Beit Jala area. I taught English classes in a house school, and at a couple of points had to run because of, you know, military coming to these schools, try to shut them down. But it was a real insight into what was, you know, a very hopeful moment at that time. Palestinians were rising up, taking charge of their destiny in various ways, including through these really interesting and very powerful nonviolent methods that I was observing. I also began working with a human rights organization, the Palestine Human Rights Information Center, which was linked to the Palestine Human Rights Campaign, which was based in Chicago. I didn't know that at the time, but as I started working with the human rights field workers, taking them, driving them up and down the West Bank and into Gaza, collecting information, I learned an immense amount about what was going on. And one of the things that I began to really focus on was the impact of the Islamic resistance movement, the Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, Hamas, on the Palestinian political situation. I remember distinctly when Hamas emerged, it had an immediate divisive impact on the Palestinian political field. Many of the people that I worked with, predominantly supportive of PLO nationalism, the various factions, I mean, this was the dominant framework of Palestinian nationalism at the time, viewed the Islamists skeptically, right? I mean, there was a perception of the Muslim Brotherhood as having actively collaborated with the Israeli occupation in Gaza because they had refused to participate in the national resistance. And so when Hamas emerged, there was, you know, deep skepticism of the movement and resentment toward it because of the way it immediately began to launch its own strike days. It had its own demonstrations. and was really attempting to impose itself on the Palestinian political field. Well, all of this got me thinking about this question of the political impact of religion. And so years later, so I ended up in 1989 leaving Palestine and going to Egypt, did a linguistics degree at the American University in Cairo, and then I went back and worked in the Gaza Strip for a couple of years with an organization called Emmet East. I was in charge of a language program for Palestinian professionals seeking to continue their education in the United States, and they were preparing for the test of English as a foreign language, the TOEFL exam. And so I was doing that from 91 to 93 at the tail end of the Intifada. This is after the Gulf War. Things were quite desperate, and tensions were mounting between Hamas and Fatah at this time. They had always been tense, but this the tension was increasing. And so again, I was sort of focused on this, curious about this, and I decided that I wanted to go in a different direction in 1993, and decided that I would go and study theology. I was, you know, at the time still very much a committed Christian, but interested in interfaith relations and interested in this question of religion and politics. I did a theology degree at the Lutheran School of Theology, and during that time figured out I didn't really want to work with the church, but got interested in the sociology of religion, and an opportunity opened up for me to pursue a PhD at the University of Chicago with Martin Wiesebrot, a sociologist. And I ended up doing my dissertation, focusing on the impact of Hamas on Palestinian identity. The Fulbright grant, I did a year of field work at the very end of the Oslo period, 1999-2000, right before the second Intifada. And that field work involved multiple conversations, 80 formal interviews, and many, many other conversations with Palestinians across the political field. The diverse factions, as well as the across the religious spectrum, the geographic spectrum, men and women, and generational as well, generational spectrum as well, really trying to understand how people my age, who were in their 20s during the first Intifada, were grappling with and negotiating with the transformed political environment that resulted from the first Intifada, and specifically with the rise of Hamas. Now, the focus wasn't on Hamas per se. It was on the impact of all of this on people's identities and how they were negotiating these tensions at the individual level, obviously situated in different social and political formations. But that was my focus. It was at this sort of individual level. And I ended up writing a book, Identity and Religion in Palestine, that was published by Princeton in 2007, based on that fieldwork. Well, so I mentioned that I was at the University of Chicago during the 1990s. And it was during that decade that I began to become connected to the Palestinian immigrant community in Chicago. And I at one point was volunteering, teaching English at the Markaz Jalil Arabiya, the Arab Community Center, at 63rd and Kedzie on the southwest side. And it was through that experience that I began to become connected to this network of activists, primarily secularists, secular nationalists, people that I, you know, had shared the same sort of orientations that I had encountered among the groups of people that I interacted with in Palestine itself. But during this time of the 1990s, I was really struck by something that became increasingly evident, and that was that the younger generation of activists were beginning increasingly to identify with Islam, and doing so in very visible ways. Women started to wear the hijab, headscarf, and men were growing their beards and praying in the corners of the Markaz. And the Markaz was well known for being very left of center politically and very secular in its orientations. So it was quite striking to see this happening in that kind of space. And I became curious about this, right? And so after I got back from doing my field work in 2000, I continued to see this phenomenon. And then, of course, 9/11 occurred, right? And there was this, you know, backlash in the United States against Muslims and against Islam. And this also then began to raise questions for me about what the impact of all of this had been on these kinds of friends that I was observing during the 1990s. Well, that question stayed with me. And later, around 2010, I thought, well, you know, it'd be really interesting, I think significant, to launch a separate study focusing on the immigrant context, asking similar questions about the relationship of religion to national and political identity, but to do so in the context of the American diaspora setting of Chicago. And so at that point, then I was able to begin a period of field work during the summers, and then finally in 2013, landed an NEH grant, National Endowment for Humanities grant, that allowed me to do a year of formal field work, followed by another leave that I got through my university. So I had 2 years of formal field work there from 2013 to 2015, during which I was able to finish up the field work and begin writing this book on Palestinian Chicago that we're talking about today. So, Roberto, that's an extremely long answer, but it is kind of the context for the project we're talking about today.
And it's extremely interesting because obviously it shows your connection, not just in Palestine, but also with a local community in Chicago. And as you mentioned, the book explores the shift that you already mentioned within the Palestinian community from secular to religious. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense, a brief sense of your main argument.
Sure. So I will try to be as brief as possible here. I guess the main assertion in the book is that a religious turn or shift did indeed occur in Chicago, and that this turn paralleled and interacted with a similar shift in Palestine, but was not reducible to what had occurred in Palestine with the emergence of Hamas. And it was very important to me, right, to make this distinction that the diaspora context is distinct and different, even though there obviously are interconnections and interactions as people go back and visit family and spend time in Palestine and come back to Chicago. So there is an ongoing relationship between homeland and diaspora that's tangible and real. Nevertheless, the context of Chicago in the United States presents a very different setting, politically, historically, socially. And this is often lost, right, in the discussion about Islam in the United States. After 9/11, it was very common, you know, in the media to encounter perspectives that viewed immigrants, Muslim immigrants, as simply outposts of these countries from which they came, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or other countries in the Middle East, as if immigrants were just simply these automatons enacting the cultural and political directions or predilections of you know, these radical movements, right, that the United States was very focused on, Americans were very focused on in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So it was very important to me, right, to make that distinction. So the religious turn in Chicago was real. It parallels the shift in that we notice in Palestine, but it takes very distinct directions, right? So I make the argument that there is a kind of a complex interaction of homeland and diaspora-specific processes in the emergence of this religious shift. The homeland factors obviously include the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood and later of Hamas, and the impact of these developments that these developments have on the PLO-led nationalism and the secular national ethos generally within Palestinian society and politics. And I mentioned the diaspora homeland networks and travel and so forth and so on. The diaspora specific factors included development of Islamic religious institutions as part of the process of selective assimilation into the Chicago and U.S. Arab and Muslim minority context, wealth accumulation and the suburban demographic shift. There was a shift that I described in the book in which, and this is typical of immigrant communities, right? There's a process of wealth accumulation and a movement socioeconomically into the middle classes, and this is signified very tangibly in movements into the suburbs. But this is a process that in Chicago and other urban contexts that remains deeply racialized. And so when you look at Chicago, for example, the far west suburbs and northern suburbs remain, very white, very wealthy. The suburbs into which Palestinians, Latino, Latina communities move into are nearer to the urban center. And sociologists refer to this process as the browning of the suburbs, right? So these are immigrant communities that move from enclaves within the city into these near suburbs. But it's all a part of this process of selective assimilation, wealth accumulation. Along with that, at least in the Palestinian situation, we notice a shuttering or marginalizing of secular nationalist community centers that goes along with this demographic shift. And with that as well, the emergence of religious institutions, mosques in the suburbs that begin to serve the function of anchors for these communities. And then finally, I talk about the backlash against Arab and Muslim immigrants in the long aftermath of 9/11. It's a backlash that continues, but it has a very powerful effect on this whole process of the religious shift that I described. The second argument I make is that the religious shift and the tensions it produces with secularism have generated a range of hybrid identities in the present. So this is not a simple sort of one direction monolithic transformation, but rather generates a diversity of negotiations and identity expressions. And this is really the work of my book, is to document these different paths that individuals go in as they negotiate the emerging religiosity and the ongoing importance of the secular tradition within the community. So I make the argument that secularism has not disappeared as a social and political orientation within Chicago's Palestinian communities, something that is very easy to overlook with the kind of myopic emphasis, both in academia and in the media, on Islam. I make the argument that secularism has remained an important force and tradition, but that it has also taken new forms, ironically, in a kind of reaction against the new piety, especially among younger individuals. I also make the argument that the Islamic orientations manifest in complex ways. And in doing so, they actually bear the imprint of secularism as it evolves in indeterminate directions. And then finally, there are a host of other mitigating and intersecting factors that shape these processes: race, class, and generational locations of individuals, and spatial dynamics. There's one story that I tell in the book of Rami Nashashibi, who moves in a very interesting and sort of counter direction, not to the suburbs, but to heart of the African-American community in Englewood. But I really emphasize the spatial dimension there, right? Because it is precisely that whole context of the Southwest side that enables that kind of connection that Rami develops with African-American Muslim communities and the Black nationalism in those communities. And then there's a third argument, Roberto, that I make that has more to do with the broader relevance of the Palestinian case study that I'm looking at here. It goes beyond the Palestinian case to open up insight into kind of the global implications, right, of the ways in which we and late modernity, if you will, experienced what Charles Taylor and other sociologists have referred to as a kind of dynamic of fragilization, right, where we are very aware that whatever identities or orientations and commitments that we possess are not necessarily universally shared, right, and so we have to contend with opposing perspectives and opposing movements, and have to contend with that and make sense of that, come to terms with that. And I think the Palestinian case that I present opens up insights into how individuals grapple with that and find ways to make sense of their lives, both individually and as a community, in that context of division, political division, social, religious tension, and so forth. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, what I argue in the book.
And I want to ask briefly about two key terms that you already mentioned and explained, but I wonder if you want to add a little bit more about the question of religion and secularism, particularly in the context of Palestine and the diaspora in Chicago.
Yes. Thank you. Excellent question. I just want to begin first by saying that I define secularism and religion as ideal types, and I kind of go out of my way in the book to explain what ideal types are, and especially to emphasize that they are not in any form a kind of claim to essence. I'm not defining the essence of anything here. So what is an ideal type? It's an ideal type, while it's drawn from empirical data, historical and ethnographic examples, it emphasizes certain features of a phenomenon we're looking at. And it doesn't exist in any empirical way. It's an analytical tool, if you will, a heuristic tool. It's a provisional abstraction that allows us to identify and interpret something that we see occurring and recurring in different ways, in different contexts, from one time and place to another. And we refine it as we apply it. So when I define religion and secularism in the book, I'm really putting forward provisional definitions that allow us to begin to identify phenomena that I'm interested in exploring, right, and that are important to Palestinians as well. So it's not something that I'm making up out of thin air, right? I'm drawing this from the information that I'm gathering and from my experience, you know, interacting with and living among Palestinians, in which, you know, witnessing the emergence of religion as a very powerful force. So, but for the purposes of gaining some clarity about what it is I'm trying to get at, I offer these definitions. So what is secularism? Well, secularism I define as, probably the best way to get at it would be to kind of refer to the book. And I define secularism in its pure form as encompassing any social orientation, practice, mode of solidarity, or stance that implicitly or explicitly resists, rejects, demotes, ignores, or otherwise suspends momentarily or permanently the prior claim of religious authority. And in the Palestinian case, secularism, an example of secularism would be any kind of orientation that demotes the primacy of religion as the primary framework of identity, without necessarily canceling, right? So PLO nationalism, for example, did not deny the importance of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and the identities of individuals who had an indigenous connection to Palestine, but saw these religious traditions contributing to Palestinian identity. But what was primary in terms of defining that identity was this attachment to this land of Palestine and the sharing of a language and a set of customs and traditions together, right? That transcended religious sectarian boundaries. That's different from a framework that privileges religion, right? So what is religion in my definition? Well, I draw my definition from the work of Martin Riesebrod and argue that religion refers to institutions and practices that in their implicit logic presume the existence, power, and authority of superhuman forces and the capacity to interact with and gain access to these forces for the purposes of preventing or mitigating and ending crises occurring in the body, nature, and in society. And I go on to talk about the importance of this with respect to situations in which things break down socially and politically, right? In those kinds of situations, we have witnessed how religion can emerge as people are searching for alternative frameworks, can emerge as very powerful alternatives to systems that have broken down. And I refer to this as a kind of political theodicy. And in the Palestinian case, in a situation of chronic breakdown due to the occupation, due to wars and the failures of secularism, religion in the form of Islamism emerges very powerfully, right, to reorient Palestinian nationalism in a different direction. So, you know, anything that is foregrounding a kind of commitment or an explanation, for example, that the reason why things have gone poorly and badly for us, the reason why we are suffering collectively as a people is that we have lost our way, have lost our lost our understanding and our commitment to God, and our path back is to renew our commitment to the God, to the one God, and to start to keep this God's laws collectively, and understand that we are Muslims first and foremost, and also Palestinians. But the path back is through Islam. And this was the message of the Muslim Brotherhood. Sheikh Yassin and the Islamic Collective in Gaza very much emphasized this, that, you know, in typical Muslim Brotherhood fashion, that first and foremost, the society had to be reoriented toward Islam. And once this had happened, then a more powerful solidarity would have been achieved. And from that point, then it becomes possible to launch an effective and powerful resistance, you know, to Zionism, to Israel, to the occupation. So I do want to acknowledge that, you know, that raising the question of religion in the Palestinian context is sensitive, right? Because historically, Palestinians have fought very hard to achieve recognition and acknowledgement of their movement. And the Palestinian Liberation Organization, for example, for many, many years, you know, claimed that they were the full legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, and finally achieved that when a dialogue was opened up with the Reagan administration, and leading into the Madrid peace talks and the Oslo process, right? And so the PLO achieves this kind of international recognition. So I want to acknowledge that it's sensitive, right, to talk about religion, because to do so is to implicitly call into question the unity and the singularity of Palestinian representativeness and the unity of Palestinian collective will, and to raise the specter of a kind of Orientalism, right, in which Palestinians are reduced to a kind of radical Islam, right? And we see this now, right, in the aftermath of October 7th, we see how, you know, certainly Netanyahu, but, you know, other voices in public seek to reduce the Palestinian cause to a kind of, you know, irrational, radicalized Islam, losing complete sight of the context of, you know, Palestinian expulsions after 1948 and the historical demand to return to their indigenous land and to achieve political independence. But we've got to have some way to talk about this, right? And that's why, I mean, it's important to talk about Palestinians, to talk about it. It's extremely important to find ways to talk about this phenomenon, but to do so, you know, making very clear that, you know, this is not, you know, when I do this, I am by no means intending to engage in this kind of reductive reduction of Palestinians to a Orientalist conception of Islam.
Yeah, I think this is important to highlight. More importantly, because again, the context we live in, and we saw it even recently with a number of congressmen, congresswomen here in America making the case, once again, some sort of mirroring and echoing what we heard after 9/11. So the reduction of Islam to, you know, certain groups and individuals without looking at the full picture. Now, I want to talk about the Palestinian community in Chicago, and I want to just, you know, ask a few questions together. So how did it form? Who are the people that belong to it? And also, perhaps for those who are not familiar, I know we don't have a map, this is a podcast, but, you know, to give us a sense of where they are located in Chicago, and also how historical events unfolding in Palestine, particularly since 1948, changed and affect the local Palestinian community here in Chicago.
Well, it's a great question. It's a gigantic question. We could spend, you know, the next 5 hours talking about that. I know the patience of listeners would be sorely tested. But to be as brief as I possibly can be, the community in Chicago has its origins in the late 19th century. You had individuals who began to immigrate, many of them Christians, actually, who are responding to tensions in these areas that are under Ottoman control and suzerainty at the time, and coming to the United States to explore the possibilities of commerce and so forth. And many of these individuals end up in Chicago. I spend a lot of time in the book also describing, you know, what is happening in Chicago, right? So Chicago is transforming into an industrialized city. And like other cities in the Midwest, including Detroit and Cleveland and other similar cities, especially Detroit with its auto industry, become important magnets, right, for immigrants, including Arab immigrants, and a huge Arab immigrant population community develops in Detroit around the auto industry, but also in Chicago. The Palestinians who come, as I say, were initially, many of them were Christians, and but later by the 1910s and 20s, increasingly Muslims are immigrating, and many of these individuals are young men. Louis Kankar, who pioneered the sociology of Palestinian immigration in Chicago, does a nice job in her dissertation of describing this early community, mostly young men who are living in boarding houses and setting up shops in what was then called the Black Belt, kind of in between the Black Belt, between the African-American immigrant presence and the white areas of the city. So Louise draws on this idea from Zimmel, who puts forward this concept of the stranger, right? And so the Palestinian, Arab Palestinian presence is a kind of presence that is similar to the stranger, who doesn't quite fit into the racialized categories of the United States, right? These individuals aren't Black, they're not African American, and they're not white. And so they're perceived as distinct and different by both communities, and as a consequence are capable of mediating across the racialized divide. And they do this commercially, economically, serving the African-American community, but also interacting economically with white vendors. And I bring this up because the Palestinians continue to play this mediating role, right, into the very present, in that when you look at the suburbs like Bridgeview and other, you know, near southwestern suburbs in the Chicagoland area, these are areas that are between the white suburbs, the wealthy white suburbs, and the predominantly African-American south side of the city. Again, you know, occupying this sort of middle space. But this goes back, this sort of mediating role that Palestinians play in the city, goes back to the 1920s. By the 1930s and 40s, you have a well-established pattern of these young men traveling back and forth between their villages and the city, repatriating their wealth, getting married back in the homeland, and then coming back by themselves often to resume their economic activities. But the 30s and 40s with the Great Arab Revolt, and then as the 1940s progress, Palestinian nationalism is, you know, beginning to take root, and these issues are debated among these young men in Chicago. So there's a way in which nationalism begins to shape the orientations and identities of this community already in the 30s and 40s. The 1948 war becomes a watershed, and that forces the question of remaining in Chicago. And many of these young men bring their families, and they begin to establish a more permanent, less mobile community. And this continues to be a pattern. And then, you know, with the 1967 war, there's a new wave of immigrants that come. And these individuals in the 60s and 70s are increasingly oriented toward PLO nationalism. So after 1948, you have the emergence of Fatah and other factions that become the core of the what would later become the PLO, the Fatah-controlled PLO. But after 1967, after the PLO takes control of the PLO, and Fatah emerges as the vanguard of Palestinian nationalism, the new immigrants after 67 are bringing these orientations and sentiments with them. And through a process that Louise Kankar describes as a re-Palestinianization, the community begins to orient itself around this kind of PLO secular nationalism. And as a part of that process, we see the development of these community centers, especially on the southwest side, that become the anchors of the community. By the 1980s, we start to see the emergence of Islamic orientations that are sympathetic with, aligned ideologically with Muslim Brotherhood orientation. Now, I'm going to be very careful here to say that these individuals are not, you know, Muslim Brotherhood missionaries sent by the movement in Egypt. Rather, I'm talking about affinities, right? I mean, being sympathetic to a particular kind of piety that is been articulated by the Muslim Brotherhood, that's book-centered, that is modernist, that views Islam as compatible with modern life, that seeks to reform a kind of traditional Islam viewed as, having lost or forgotten the kind of the text-centered doctrines that define Islam as these reformists understand it. And so there's a desire to bring Islam back to a kind of textual purity, back to the Quran, back to the, you know, the interpretations of the first generation of Muslims, but really seeing this as very compatible with a modern rationalist outlook and a kind of a modern ethics, professional ethics. One can lead one's life as an ethical human being, and that Islam provides perhaps the purest framework for that kind of ethical life, very compatible with being a businessman in a modern capitalist society, and really wanting to sort of reform what is perceived as a superstitious traditional Islam, to get rid of the superstition, bring it back to, you know, the core religious practices and outlooks. So this is already developing in the 80s, and by the 1990s, and especially as the Oslo process gets going, it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that the Oslo process will not result in a Palestinian state. And there's a kind of development of a disenchantment, right, with the path that the PLO has taken. We begin to see the mosques emerge as important centers. And this, as I say, parallels a process of suburbanization. So the mosques in the suburbs become the primary anchors for the community. Now you mentioned or asked about members. So there are about, it's hard to really nail down a number, but I would say there are between 80 to 150,000 Palestinians in Chicago. The majority are of Muslim background. There's an important Christian presence, especially in the Ramallah Club and in the churches in the suburbs around Chicago. Palestinian Christians tend to be located or scattered, actually, in the suburban, different suburbs. But the Muslims, the Palestinian Muslims, are primarily in the southwest suburbs. I mentioned Bridgeview, but there are other suburbs in the area that Palestinians have increasingly moved to.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But that, with that said, the Southwest enclave, Southwest side enclave, in the 63rd and Kedzie area remains still important. There are still families there, although far fewer than there used to be. And the Arab American Action Network, which is in the same premises as the Arab American Community Center that preceded it, continues to be an important institutional hub, even though in some ways the community has left, right? And Hatem Abuldeya, who is the executive director of the Arab American Action Network, has spoken about the necessity of that organization moving to the suburbs to be closer to its constituency. So in terms of geographical location, I sort of described this, but I want to say that there has been a process whereby the community's center has shifted across time. So I mentioned in the 20s and 30s and 40s, the sort of way in which the community was mediating between white and black areas of the city, and they did so kind of in the South Loop area. The community then moved, as it began to establish roots, it moved to the southwest side, and now has moved into the suburbs, in the southwest suburbs. Now, as far as the impact of events in Palestine, I've made reference to the 1948 war, the 1967 war. These were, obviously incredibly important. The 1948 war, just to review, had the impact of putting the question of, whether to remain rooted in Chicago or go back, and going back was increasingly not possible, obviously because Israel refused to allow refugees to return. In the West Bank, that was now under Jordanian rule. Gaza was under Egyptian rule. So it became harder, right? It became harder. And as a strategy to deal with the situation post-1948, many families were looking to create and to solidify connections in other countries, right? This became a strategy to survive. And so if a family could establish a presence, for example, in the United States in Chicago, then it had a kind of lifeline economically. Wealth could continue to be repatriated, but if necessary, families could be brought through family reunification to the United States. And younger people could also come and study, sponsored and supported by their families in Chicago. Maybe they go back, or maybe they continue to live in the United States. So this was, I think, an important way to respond to these events, in which the diaspora provides a kind of safety, I don't say safety valve so much as a lifeline, really. Maybe that's the better metaphor, a kind of lifeline that allows families to survive their situation. The 1967 war I mentioned also was incredibly important. In that it brought a new wave of Palestinians with very nationalist orientations, and their arrival functions to re-Palestinianize the community, bringing them into align with these very powerful trends in the region, in which Palestinians now are newly mobilized within this new nationalist, secular nationalist framework. The 1982 war in Lebanon and the First Intifada were really critical because of their impact on mobilizing the community. So, for example, the Arab Community Center, the Marquez on the southwest side, became a huge hub of activity during the 1982 war, as well as during the Intifada. There were all sorts of food drives and medical supply drives that were made. People gave, they came to events to contribute money to send back in support of Palestinians in the homeland. The Oslo Accords, 1993, again, another really important moment. I was actually in Chicago right when the Oslo Accords were signed. I had just arrived in the city, and there was this big event at the Random Worlds Cafe on the north side. And it was the first time that I had any sort of interaction with the Palestinian community. I was invited by a friend to come to this big meeting citywide meeting, really, drawing activists from across the city, Palestinian solidarity activists, Palestinian leaders from the community. We gathered at the Random Worlds Cafe, and the the mood in the meeting was quite well. There was confusion, but there was also despair. I think that's the best word. A sense that something really profound had happened, and that it was no longer clear what the Palestinian movement was really aiming for any longer. And it really seemed like the PLO and Yasser Arafat had agreed to basically relinquish historical Palestinian demands, especially as they were articulated within the context of the diaspora, the emphasis on the Haqq al-Awda, the right of return, for example, that seemed to have been relinquished here. And it wasn't clear at all from the memorandum of understanding that a Palestinian state was in the offing. And so there was a real sense of despair, a lack of a real sense of having lost any clear direction. And many of the activists that I spoke with later, older activists, secular nationalists, said that this was the moment when the secularists lost their base, and people began to turn toward the mosques as an alternative, right? And so very important moment in 1993. Obviously, 9/11, I've spoken about that already. But then, you know, the wars that have been fought between Israel and Hamas in Gaza have had, you know, impacts that have furthered this kind of religious shift. I've, in the book, I spent an entire chapter discussing the American Muslims for Palestine organization, AMP. And it was really, you know, the Taft-led operation, one of the wars that Israel fought in the aughts against Hamas, that became the catalyst for the emergence of the American Muslims for Palestine. And so in that event and the emergence of this organization, one sees a kind of further evolution of this religious nationalism within the Chicago, but also wider US context.
I want to turn now my attention to some of the case studies and so some of the individuals that form the narrative of your book. And there is one individual in particular that caught my attention, Munir, and the story of Munir is told in chapter 4. And essentially, I would like to ask about the question also of the generational change that occurred within the community and how the story of Munir explained this change.
It's a wonderful question. I really appreciate that. You know, it gets us really into the heart of the book. These stories that I tell, beginning in chapter 4, after I talk about the American Muslims in Palestine, beginning in chapter 4 and through the rest of the book, I emphasize these individual stories as a way to shed light on the generational shift that I talk about. Munir is interesting in that he's a Christian. I should emphasize that Munir is a pseudonym. And so, you know, the name and identifying details have changed. But the story that I tell here about Munir is important in a number of respects. So first of all, as a Christian, but also he is someone who grew up in a family that was politicized, right? He grows up in Jerusalem. And his family, you know, were actually aligned with the communists. And this was not uncommon among Christians to find that, you know, Christians who were politically active, nationalist in orientation, were often aligned with left-leaning movements like the Popular Front or the communists. Fatah also, of course. And I talk about how there's a kind of historical background to this, going back to the 19th century, as Christians began to embrace these emerging forms of nationalism as a way to break away from the sectarian forms of social organization, political control that were typical of the Ottoman period, in which, you know, you related to the Ottoman authority as a member of a religious community, right? And it was your religious representatives that interacted with the Ottoman authorities, you know, collecting taxes and so forth on their behalf. But, you know, nationalism offered an opportunity for Christians to stake a claim as equal citizens with a reconfigured, a different kind of community, a national community. And so Christians really embraced this from early on, and you know, this carries forward into the 20th century, and Munir's family really reflect this. But what's I think really important about Munir's story is that we see here the importance of the first Intifada, right? And so he is involved in activism and becomes, you know, mobilized during this time. But at the same time, right, he encounters the emergence of Hamas, right, a kind of resurgent Islamism. And I talked earlier in the podcast about the, you know, profound divisive impact of Hamas on the Palestinian political field in Palestine, you know, when it emerged. And one aspect of that division that took form one impact was on Christians, right? And so Christians are watching this unfold. And again, like, I want to emphasize and acknowledge how sensitive this is. So a lot of Christians will say, don't want to make too much of this because, you know, Christians remain deeply committed to the Palestinian national cause. But many of the Christians that I interacted with in my first, in the field work for my first book, were talking about a phenomenon in which they were withdrawing into their, you know, confessional sectarian communities. And this is something that happens with Munir, right? Now, while he's still in Jerusalem, he becomes connected to, through the church that he's attending, the Anglican church that he's attending in Jerusalem, he becomes connected to the emerging Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center and Palestinian Liberation Theology. And so one of the phenomena is that, you know, Palestinian Christians began to articulate a kind of analog to Hamas. It's not, Sabeel isn't Hamas, right? But it's this idea of religion, of a religious nationalism, right? And the analog for Christians is really this kind of liberation theology. Munir is sort of drawn into this. But at a really critical point, he leaves Palestine. He has an opportunity to study at a university in Chicago on the north side. And this transition of his into the diaspora actually begins to reshape his politics, because at this really critical moment in the 90s, right, I talked about how the Palestinian community now is beginning to shift toward an Islamic orientation. Munir experiences this and, you know, initially is involved in the Arab Community Center on the southwest side, attending events there. But, you know, as he describes, you know, increasingly the you know, the meetings at the Arab Community Center, the Markaz, you know, begin with Bismillah Rahman Rahim, and there are prayer spaces set aside. And it just seems like what had been a non-sectarian nationalist space had become transformed. And Christians, he said as much, right? He said he went to a Palestinian conference at the center. He was asked to bring Christians. Very few came because, he said, most Christians view any kind of event having to do with Palestine as a potentially Muslim thing. And he said that they were right about this. At this event that he attended, the hafla, the social event, the evening, he said, took an Islamic turn. There were people chanting for Muslim Palestine. And he said it was a reflection of what the community thought and felt. It was eye-opening to him. And so he's still very committed, as a Palestinian nationalist, to the Palestinian cause, but feels alienated because there seems to have been a loss of space within which Christians would feel comfortable, welcomed, right? That didn't have this kind of accommodation of Islam and a reframing of the national identity in terms of an Islamic component. And so this is, in some senses, you know, Munir's story then describes his process, but he himself is undergoing a kind of sectarianizing, right, as he gets involved with his own conservative evangelical church through his wife. And he feels very ambivalent about this, right, because he's encountering other Arab Christians here who are from other parts of the Middle East, like Syria and Iraq, who are expressing deep anger at Muslims blaming all the problems of Christians on Muslims, on radical Muslims and on Islam. And he said, that wasn't my experience so much in Palestine. It was, you know, the occupation, it was Zionism. And that's not, you know, during the Intifada, that's not the way that we thought, right? It didn't really matter because we were all being arrested. We were all in the struggle together. But then he said, you know, it's hard in this situation now as the community has become much more identified with Islam, at least, you know, at the time that I was interacting with them in the, you know, the aughts and in the teens, you know, 2015, 2013 and earlier, you know, he was experiencing the community as having, you know, gone in this direction, the sectarianizing direction, right? And seeing very little kind of opportunity or space, really neutral space for him as a non-Muslim Palestinian, deeply committed to Palestinian liberation still, but experiencing this kind of sectarianism process as a dividing factor, right? And needing to a Christian retreat, you know, and withdrawal into a Christian sectarian space.
As a historian, when I was reading the story of Munir, I was actually reminded of a famous Palestinian nationalist, Khalil al-Sakakini, experienced something similar. I mean, in his early writings, obviously, he never looked at the question of religion for him. Nationalism was inherently secular, but throughout the 1930s, particularly in the period of the Arab Revolt and with the emergence of certain figures like Ajal Amin Husseini, and he came to understand that there was an element there that might have been a problem in the future, and he's writing about it. And essentially, he always says, well, we are also a minority, not just in terms of number, but also as a religion, you know, Christianity can only be part of Islam, but there is something there. And I found this very intriguing and interesting about all of these difficulties of managing religion and secularism when facing, you know, a major battle, as in this case. I want to move to the last chapter, one that we probably could have hours-long conversation because I found fascinating. And you talk about three fundamental dynamics: reversion, conversion, and accommodation. You talk about a number of individuals, and I want to ask just if you can tell us something about their stories and how they fit this very fascinating chapter. So here we're talking about Nawal, Rami, that you already mentioned, and Najwa.
Yeah, okay. Briefly, so I developed these very sort of potentially confusing terms, and I freely admit to this, they were not very elegant terms. I develop a concept of religious secularity and secular religiosity, and I see these as distinct. In terms of religious secularity, what this is describing, this shift or movement from a secular to a religious orientation, and secular religiosity goes in the other direction, from religious to secular orientations. And was really trying to, these terms are really kind of trying to capture trajectories, they're moving in different directions. But in terms of religious secularity, I describe these three possibilities of reversion, conversion, and accommodation. And by reversion, what I mean is a shift from piety to secularism back to piety. So there's a kind of reverting back and forth. Conversion is more of a unidirectional, one-way shift from a secular to a religious orientation. And then finally, accommodation entails adaptation to and partial identification with the religious milieu and the suburban middle-class piety that makes that marks it culturally. Nawal, again, a pseudonym, is the individual that I highlight to illustrate the process of reversion, this oscillation back and forth between religion and secularity. And I found her, you know, to be profoundly compelling as a figure, because of the sincerity and authenticity of her story, right? I mean, she really spoke very much from the heart. She was at the time a young woman who got involved in the Mudakas, in this secular organizing space, leftist secular organizing space. And, the head of the Arab American Action Network actually referred to her as one of our own, right? That she was somebody who he thought of as one of their core activists. And she was. She continued to be very active in the center when I interviewed her. But she, grows up in the Mosque Foundation, the major mosque on the southwest side. Her family moves to the suburbs as part of this whole process of the demographic shift in the 1990s, 80s and 90s. And she grows up in the Mosque Foundation community and goes to the Al-Aqsa School, which is a predominantly Palestinian, Islamically oriented school. And she described how she really loved the school, and she, absorbs, right, the practices of piety, prayer, and study the Quran, and describes a process of really learning how Islam, in her view, was supposed to be practiced, as opposed to the kind of cultural Islam that she describes as growing up with in her family, right? Her parents didn't really understand Islam. Her mom didn't dress properly. She wore a scarf behind her head, but not in the way that it was supposed to be worn, as she understood it, in terms of a kind of reformist piety with a scarf pinned tightly under her chin, didn't perform the prayer properly in her view. And so there was a process of learning and relearning Islam within this religious space that was created through the Mosque Foundation and the school. But then her parents, couldn't afford the Al-Aqsa School and put their kids, Noelle included, into the public schools. And that kind of transitioned into a different kind of institutional, cultural milieu led to her being less pious, less practicing, right? It wasn't that she stopped believing, but she didn't pray as much. She didn't, it just wasn't part of the structure of her life. And I bring that up because I think this the factor of the milieu, right, the institutional context really matters in terms of how an individual comes to see himself or herself and the kinds of practices that one engages in. The social has a very powerful impact on the individual. And when you shift institutional context, you adapt. And it's hard. It's hard to kind of not adapt, right, and to maintain your difference. So then later, however, she goes to university and she gets involved with the Muslim Student Association. At the same time, she gets involved with Students for Justice in Palestine. And so she's becoming reconnected to Islam, but also connected to Palestinian nationalism. And through that, becomes connected to the Arab Community Center and the Arab American Action Network. And along the way, her mother dies. And she finds herself reciting Quran as her mother is dying in the hospital, wearing the scarf as she's reciting Quran and becoming rehabituated to wearing the scarf. So there's a way again here where life moments, key life moments like this intervene, and she finds her way back into piety. But what I thought was really interesting about Noelle was how she later has to negotiate these tensions between her piety and her desire to retain or impose a kind of constancy across different institutional spaces, the activist space, her family, who don't observe the way that she does, or not at all. And she's refusing to shake the hands of men who could be potential marriageable partners. And this is all very alienating in these other kinds of settings that she's engaged with, the activist setting where, the ethic is to hug one another. And she's not hugging men, right? And this is, seen as, people don't know what to make of that, right? And similarly in her family, she's not hugging uncles that she used to hug. And she ultimately has to relent and kind of make her peace with shaking hands, so as to smooth social interaction as she moves across different kinds of spaces. So again, this kind of reversion process, this oscillation, is what I'm getting at here. Conversion, I talk a lot about Rami Nashashibi and really focus in on his story, which I just found so compelling. But You know, Rami grows up in this family, the Meshachivi family, well-known, wealthy family in Jerusalem, very political family. The Meshachivis served in Jerusalem's municipal government prior to 1948. And so he kind of comes from royalty, from Palestinian royalty, if we can put it that way, right? And his father was an ambassador and connected to the PLO. So he's, you know, at a high level, right? His family had been very political. And Rami himself, I mean, his family was secular, not, you know, sort of apathetically secular, just simply didn't observe Islam, you know, religion just wasn't a part of his upbringing. And then, you know, Rami and his embrace of secular nationalism began to be more actively atheist and viewed religion as a real problem and an impediment to the Palestinian liberation project. But all of that begins to change for him when he comes to the United States and attends college in Chicago and gets involved in the Arab American Community Center on the Southwest Side. And as a consequence of that, begins to interact with Black Muslims who are drawn to the Palestinian cause. You know, because the leaders of the Arab American Community Center really forged connections with the anti-apartheid movement, with the Puerto Rican nationalist movement, all of these different movements, and really sought to establish links of solidarity among the different causes. These kinds of solidarity networks existed, and Rami began to interact with people, especially African Americans, who were coming from a Black nationalist and ultimately Black Muslim background. This has this kind of ironic impact that he's drawn into Islam and becomes, he uses the word, I converted, I undergo this conversion process and become a Muslim. And he embraces Islam, but it's through the medium of hip-hop, medium of Black nationalism and black Muslim piety that kind of, he begins to articulate an Islamic cosmopolitanism that he sees as similar to Edward Said's secular cosmopolitanism. And he puts forward this vision of Islam as an attractive alternative, right, to the narrow nationalism, whether in the form of PLO nationalism or in Hamas religious nationalism. He sees Islam as offering a different path to Palestinians, but one that requires a decentering of the Palestinian cause, not its rejection, but a decentering of it alongside, you know, the causes of other peoples and other groups, right, and the forging of real links of solidarity. Rami's a really compelling example here of conversion that moves in a very different direction than other Palestinians are moving in terms of this return to Islam or this Islamic revival. And finally, a combination actually features an individual named Intisar, and she is somebody who remains secular, but accommodates the mosques and begins to move into the institutional space of the mosques as an avenue for her own political work, right? And this is post 9/11. She actually speaks in very vivid terms of how the Islam in her exploded after 9/11 because of the anti-Muslim backlash. And being identified now not as Palestinian, but as Muslim, right? And she said, well, they're attacking me as a Muslim, I'm going to fight back as a Muslim. But she didn't wear a scarf. When I interviewed her, she was eating or smoking, I think, during Ramadan. She was smoking on the back steps of the Arab American Action Network office space. But she was sending her daughter to an Islamic school in the Mosque Foundation community and was working with the sheikh at the mosque. Really sort of accommodating the religious trend, even as she retained her secularist moorings. So this kind of gives you some sense of the way in which I'm interacting with this kind of data, right? These individual stories, right? These individual narratives as a way to get into the complexity of these processes.
And that brings me to the final question. Now, you completed this work in 2017. Can you share with us your conclusion at the end of the research? So how do, you know, the stories connect with your propositions at the beginning? And I'm also curious to know whether you've been in touch with the community ever since, and if you can trace for us perhaps the latest developments.
Yes, good questions. So as you say, I completed the research in 2017. In my concluding chapter, I feature the story of Rosnea Oze, who in 2017 becomes the target of the FBI and is accused of lying on her, or fabricating, or making up details on her application for citizenship. And she, there's her indictment sparks a major effort on the part of the Arab American Action Network to support her, to mobilize around her case, and in a sense to place the United States and Israel under the microscope. She ultimately loses, well, she doesn't lose, she doesn't go to trial, she agrees to a plea deal and agrees to leave the United States and without any further time served. But I emphasize her case because of how it brings up a whole set of continuing factors that play out to this very day. Now, I have to be clear that I have not continued to have ongoing conversations with my interlocutors in Chicago. So when I concluded the research in 2017, as I said, I didn't continue those conversations. I maintained informal conversations and so forth. And I was just in Chicago at Northwestern University, organized a panel of activists reflecting on October 7th and especially the way in which activism in Chicago sort of transcends Jewish and Arab lines of difference. But I use the example of Rosnea Oze as a way to emphasize the continuing importance of the Palestinian cause as a an orienting framework for the community. I mean, it seems like an obvious point, but I've made much in the book of this religious shift. But the point being that the nationalist cause continues. And it is often re-energized, right, by these experiences of being targeted by U.S. law enforcement. The recent election of Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, who was Somali but nevertheless very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, and the way in which Rashida Tlaib becomes targeted in the Congress also, again, sparks this sense in the community of being under attack and the necessity of fighting back. A second point that I make in conclusion is that the inherent secularity of the nationalist question has also affected the reformist Islam that has gained ascendancy since the late 1980s. And I refer here to the way in which, a lot of the organizing around Rosnea spans not only includes the secular institutions like the AAA and the Arab American Action Network, but also included activists with the American Muslims for Palestine, right? So there's a way in which the issue brings people together across the religious and secular lines here, institutional lines. There are other, but in emphasizing that, I also point out that what has taken place here in terms of the religious shift isn't inconsequential and will continue to play out in different ways, right? And I think that's certainly been the case. One thing that we didn't really talk about in the book or in our conversation was the point that I make that in some other examples, right, that I show how the religious shift has also led to a kind of recouping or reviving of secularism, but in a different form, right? And I highlight individuals who are seeking to move out of the suburban enclave and seeking out other avenues for themselves, rejecting piety, rejecting, in some cases, rejecting Islam outright, right, and embracing a kind of atheist identity. And I don't want to be clear that I don't want to make too much of this, right? I don't know how generalizable this is. My study was not in any way survey-based. I have no basis for making broad generalizations. But what I was picking up here in my fieldwork was that one unexpected direction that something I didn't expect was to see this kind of response to the turn toward piety that involved a kind of rejection of piety and an embrace of either a non-sectarian spirituality or in some cases an atheism, but seen as very much as a kind of further consequence or elaboration of the dynamics that I discussed in the book.
This was Lauren Leibarger, author of Palestinian Chicago, Identity in Exile, published by University of California Press in 2020. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto. It's been a pleasure to have this chance to talk with you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook @JerusalemUnplugged. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.